Do you remember when the internet was fun? Do you recall logging on to the information superhighway back in the day with a sense of wonder and awe at the things that you might discover? Well, if you're a grizzled, gray-bearded old veteran of the digital domain, chances are you might be able to cast your mind back to such a time. But if you were born after the year 2000, I'm betting you're struggling to believe that such a feeling was even possible. Yes, as we all know, the internet and all of its associated services and applications and devices have gotten worse and worse every single year. But as you may or may not know, there's a handy-dandy word to identify this very phenomenon.
Hi, nice to see you all. So a couple of years ago, I coined this term in shitification to describe how online platforms decay. And it describes a three-stage process. First, you have platforms that are good to their end users, but find a way to lock those end users in. So think of Google, which initially minimized ads and maximized the spend on engineering for high-quality search results. But as they were doing that, they were also buying their way to dominance. So that no matter which browser you use, no matter what mobile operating system you were using, no matter which carrier you had, you would always be searching on Google by default. In stage two, platforms start to abuse their users in order to tempt in business customers. So for Google, obviously, that's advertisers and web publishers. So today, an ever larger fraction of a Google results page is given over to ads, and those ads are marked up with ever subtler, ever smaller type that says the word ad next to it. So, and Google uses commercial surveillance to target ads to us. So that's stage two, making things better for business customers while making things worse for end users. And so once the business customers are locked into the platform, you get stage three of enshittification. This is where Google claws back all the value in the platform, both from business customers and from end users, leaving behind just like a homeopathic residue of value, just enough to keep everyone locked in while the rest of the value is gathered in for shareholders and executives, and Google becomes enshittified.
That's right. Enshittification. Yes, it is a real word. It's not a swear word. It's even in Merriam-Webster. So there you go. Enshittification. Noun. When a digital platform is made worse for users in order to increase profits. And hey, it was even the word of the year for 2023 as selected by the American Dialect Society. So you know it's legit. But if you want the simple one-paragraph encapsulation of this idea, let's turn to the person who coined the term there, Cory Doctorow, who first coined it in November of 2022, but elaborated in this January 2023 article for Wired on the enshittification of TikTok, where he described in one simple-to-understand paragraph what this process is. Here is how platforms die. First, they are good to their users. Then, they abuse their users to make things better for their business customers. Finally, they abuse their business customers to claw back all the value for themselves. Then they die. And he calls this process enshittification, and there's much more detail to this and specifically how it works. But again, I imagine that most of my listeners already have some experience of this phenomenon and already understand how it works. But the question for today's exploration is not really how this works or what it is. The question is, what do we do about it? Because you are watching Solutions Watch. And so today, we're going to tackle the subject of de-enshittifying the internet. Now, obviously, that's a very tall order, and it admits of some very big ideas, systematic structural changes that would need to be made at the macro level in order to de-enshittify the internet and these platforms for all. Well, that's not what we're going to be tackling today. Today, we're going to talk more about the narrow focus answers and solutions, that tiny little things that you can do to somewhat improve your online experience, at least a little bit, so it's not quite as terrible as it has become. There are things that you can do, at any rate. Now, I suppose if we were to look at those big systemic issues and the answers and solutions that one might proffer at that level, well, you could turn, for example, to that clip from that Cory Doctorow presentation. The link to the entire presentation will be in the show notes, as always, and you can go watch that entire presentation in which Doctorow lays out some of his own ideas for this. But you will also notice that he, of course, takes a very statist interventionist approach to this, and talking about regulators and the EU can improve things by making their own app store, et cetera, et cetera. I think we know how that story goes and why that might not be the type of thing that I would be promoting here on Solutions Watch, but by all means, go explore that for yourself if you're so inclined. But we won't be looking at that type of idea. Instead, let's look at more specific personal things that you can do today to improve your online experience. And we're going to start, well, why not start from Cory Doctorow himself? As you may or may not know, he has a blog called Pluralistic, Daily Links from Cory Doctorow. And quite recently, just a few weeks ago, he had this post up, "The web is bearable with RSS." Wow. Exactly what I've been saying for years now. Great. I'm glad to see this idea is getting more attention, as it should. For those who do not know anything whatsoever about RSS, please consult my Solutions Watch on this subject. Really Simple Syndication, which I had 5 years ago in February of 2021 on Solutions Watch. What is RSS? How does it work? How does it make your online experience better? All of the details, or at least a lot of them, will be there for you to get started on your RSS journey. But as Cory Doctorow goes on to explain, there was once a time when an ever-increasing proportion of web users kept tabs on what was going on with RSS. RSS is a simple, powerful way for websites to publish feeds of their articles and for readers to subscribe to those feeds and get notified when something new was posted, and even read that new material right there in your RSS reader tab or app. And as he goes on to note, RSS is simple and versatile. It is the backbone of podcasts. It's how podcasts function. These feeds are untouched by human hands, as in there's no third-party middleman getting in between you and the person you are attempting to subscribe to. No algorithmic manipulation going on. It is simply a chronological list of posts from whoever you are actually subscribing to. And above all, it's a way to find out when something new has been published on the web. But you will note that he uses the past tense here. It was a way for people to get notified when something new was posted. Why is he talking about RSS in the past tense? It's because RSS has been effectively killed as at least something common in the common internet vocabulary of people today. In fact, I find a lot of people have never even heard of RSS at this point, which is flabbergasting for me, because a couple of decades ago when I first got into podcasting, of course, everyone knew what RSS was and had some form of RSS reader, at least to get their podcasts, if nothing else. But as I have intimated before, and I really need to do a specific deep dive on this because it is an incredibly instructive case study about how things are subverted. But as Dr. O notes here, in 2013, Google quietly knifed Reader, its RSS reader that it had taken over. I've always found the timing suspicious. It came right in the middle of Google's desperate scramble to become Facebook by means of a product called Google Plus. And people may or may not remember the ridiculous Google Plus social media attempt that Google made there. Anyway, yeah, there is a story there, and it is definitely worth pursuing. And hopefully I will have the time and leisure to pursue that at some point in the future. But for the meantime, yes, I think RSS is a great, wonderful way to cut out the social media crap and noise and actually access the information you want from the people you want without any algorithmic manipulation coming in between. Of course, there is an asterisk here. I did receive an email recently from someone hearing me hyping up RSS and talking about it, who notes that they only ever go to the library to access the internet once a week and was wondering if they can use RSS because they don't have a device of their own. And I must admit, that is a quandary. Unless the local library will let you install a newsreader on their computer, I don't think RSS would be a viable solution for you. So maybe it has its limitations. But assuming you do have a device that you have control of, RSS, I think, is much better than being on Twitter or whatever else passes for a news source these days. So, as I say, please go to see Really Simple Syndication, my edition of Solutions Watch from 5 years ago, if you want more information about how to get started on your RSS journey. But let's keep moving. Let's look at another idea. This is called D-Arrow, and it's at darrow.ajay.app. Again, all the links will be in the show notes for today's edition of Solutions Watch. D-Arrow describes itself as an open source browser extension for crowdsourcing better titles and thumbnails on YouTube. The goal is to make titles accurate and reduce sensationalism. No more arrows, ridiculous faces, and no more clickbait. Yep, you better believe, of course, YouTube is filled with that crap. And every channel does it, including the Corbett Report, because you can hate the game, but don't hate the player. You got to play the game, right? So, no, you don't have to play the game. You hate the thumbnail, the clickbait thumbnails and titles? Well, install Dero and whoop, you can suddenly get rid of all of that stuff. If this is just, of course, the what they're showing you on the page here. But if you go to YouTube, for example, I have it installed here on this browser, and you will see what looks like refreshingly clickbait-free sort of thumbnails of actual, oh, this is what the video actually looks like. If you want to see the clickbait thumbnail, hover over it. And oh yeah, there it is, the clickbait thumbnail with the clickbait title. But if you unhover, oh, there it is. So you can see what is actually in the video rather than this silly arrow and whatever clickbait thumbnail they've got. Plus, this also works for titles, but this is, as the arrow is indicating here, it is a crowdsource list, essentially, of better titles and thumbnails on YouTube. So the way it works, as I understand it, is people can submit their ideas for, okay, I've watched this video and the title was totally not related to what this is really about. This is what it's really about. And but that does require that someone actually submit a suggestion for a better title. So very, very popular videos on very, very popular channels no doubt have their own titles and what have you. But for more niche channels, it probably doesn't exist yet. Anyway, don't use YouTube in general, but if you do, at the very least, this D-Arrow can help with your YouTube experience and at least make it a little bit more browsable without being so clickbait heavy. Let's look at idea number three. Idea number three on our list is AISloplist.com, which will take you to this, which is a homepage for a browser extension. It says, take back your YouTube feed. Block AI-generated slop content from your YouTube experience. A community-maintained block list with browser extensions for Firefox and Chrome. And once you install it, you'll see that this is a community-maintained block list curated and updated by the community. Anyone can suggest channels to add through GitHub issues or Discord. Real-time blocking. The extension hides AI slop channels instantly as you browse YouTube. No page reloads needed. Content disappears automatically. The block list automatically syncs from GitHub. No tracking, no analytics, no data collection. The extension only reads the block list and then filters your feed locally. 100% open source and transparent. And yes, if you want to look at the actual source, you can, of course, go to GitHub, or you can just install the extension. When you do, you will note that, let's see how far it takes. Oh, there we go. So YouTube is trying to recommend me some sort of AI slop, but it has been blocked by this extension. You can, if you want, manually override that, show anyway, and then you can see the AI slop that it's trying to feed you. But you know what? Maybe I don't want to see that anyway. So that is, again, just a simple little thing you install, and suddenly it will block channels that it knows through its community-maintained list are feeding AI slop and nonsense. So hat tip to my guitar instructor and friend, Vinny Caggiano, for that tip. He recently had the experience of watching a channel, getting intrigued by a story that he was watching, deciding to check, is this real? And discovering, no, it's AI slop hallucinated nonsense of people that don't exist doing things that aren't real. So, it's becoming a more and more important phenomenon. So hopefully if people use this and actually submit information to the repository, the blocklist repository, hopefully people can have a slightly less AI-driven YouTube experience. But let's keep going. We're going to look at idea number four, the small web. Have you heard of the small web? This is an idea that's been propounded in various forms. Here's a Reddit post from a couple of years ago. For those unaware, the small web, sometimes called Yesterweb or IndieWeb, is a generalized term for websites outside of big tech social media and which operate outside of or deliberately in opposition to common social media standards. These can be old websites created before the social media era, or they can be newer sites like da-da-da. And there are several examples here. So it's a 2000s revival, greater control over your internet browsing experience, escaping polarization and identity politics. All of the things that we used to love about the old web web, World Wide Web, right? Before it became the modern internet as we know it. Well, here's one way to start accessing that small web idea. Here's a search engine that specifically searched for small web websites. Rather than giving you Facebook and Instagram and whatever links, it will give you real curated, homemade, old-fashioned websites, the kind that we might be able to remember. So me being me, as I'm testing this out, the very first thing I'm going to search for is, what did I used to search for back in, I don't know, the 1990s when I was first on the internet? Oh, right, like, I don't know, Smashing Pumpkins. So if you put pumpkins in here, and, oh, okay, well, after Crumpkins Pumpkins, which I don't know what that is, but, stevehemming.co.uk. Starla.org, I remember that site, and you click over here, and, oh, wow, this is what the web used to look like. Remember that? And, oh, look at this, themes and fonts of a scorched earth. Wow, look at, you can download all of the Smashing Pumpkins fonts, probably up to about the year 2000 or whenever this webpage stopped being maintained. But that's it. Brock, I demand for our clickbait thumbnail for this video, use the Siamese Dream font for the text, please. Thank you. All right. So anyway, this is one way of accessing the old web as you know it. Search for whatever you like and see what you find from there. Perhaps you will find something real, human, curated content, not garbage slop that's being put out by content creators and influencers and whatever inorganic material you might find these days. Okay, let's move on to the next tip. Tip number 5. This is an interesting tip for an interesting phenomenon that you may or may not know about and that you can find out about in, for example, this recent Wired article from the past day or two, the rise of the Ray-Ban meta creep. Between pickup artists and juvenile pranksters, the wearable device is becoming associated with pests of all kinds. And this is talking about the snazzy new Ray-Ban Meta smart glasses. Have you seen them now? You can put on the glasses and they have that little camera in there that can record your interactions and conversations. And I believe there is supposed to be a red light that indicates that something is being recorded. Most people don't even know what that is. And there are apparently ways to counteract and circumvent that light anyway. So who knows what weirdo is recording whatever interactions are happening on the street in real life now? And they give some examples of that and then talk about that phenomenon. The proliferation of social media accounts in which content creators use smart glasses to record their public interactions for huge audiences. But these conversations aren't always so innocent. Users pulling juvenile pranks on retail workers, men prowling sun-soaked beaches and corridors of city nightlife so they can showcase their attempts to pick up women, etc. So yes, Meta's glasses are equipped with potentially invasive AI services as well. Already, the Meta app that runs on the device can collect your videos for further AI training. So guess what? Even just by using them, just by wearing these glasses, you are inadvertently feeding the AI data beast as well. And hey, you don't even have to use them yourself. Maybe you're just walking down the street and someone is recording you and your physical appearance is being fed into the AI data beast. So anyway, this is a growing phenomenon that you might want to be aware of. And what can you possibly do about it? Well, now there is an app called Nearby Glasses that at the very least can alert you to the fact that there is some Meta Ray-Ban pervert in your vicinity.
As smart glasses from companies like Meta and Snap start showing up in the real world, a new app called Nearby Glasses has launched with a simple idea: alert you if smart glasses are nearby. The app works by scanning for the Bluetooth signals that some smart glasses devices broadcast. If someone with compatible smart glasses, especially ones that communicate with a phone or headset over Bluetooth, is close to you, the app can recognize that signal and send a notification saying, "Hey, there's smart glasses nearby."
Well, anyway, it's something that can hopefully make your outside experience a little bit more comfortable to at least know when these glasses are around, assuming that they are attached via Bluetooth to some sort of device. Caveat, caveat, asterisk, asterisk. If there are better ways of dealing with this in the future, please do let me know. I would be interested to hear about them. But that is something that you can at least install right now today to combat a problem that you may have been blissfully unaware was even a problem. Let us move along to tip number 6. For de-inshittifying the internet, let's talk about a problem that you may come across now and then. For example, let's say that you are reading your copy of Reportage, Essays on the New World Order, available now in hardcover, paperback, audiobook, and or EPUB from reportagebook.com. And you come across a reference in there, for example, and reference in the Escaping the Grand Chessboard essay on the 2008 book Superclass, The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making by David Rothkopf. A global elite has emerged over the past several decades that has vastly more power than any other group on the planet. Each of the members of this superclass has the ability to influence the lives of millions of people in multiple countries worldwide. Each actively exercises this power, and they often amplify it through the development of relationships with others in this class. And you go to EndNote 58 and you find that, as a book, end note, this is not linked. There's no link available for this for you to go to, unlike the other references, which are, of course, linked when possible. But for example, in this book reference, it's not linked, but it does have all of the details. Superclass, The Global Power Elite in the World They're Making, New York, Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, 2009, pages 19 and 20. So what do you do? Well, how about going to archive.org. And hopefully you're familiar with Archive right now, but if not, why not go there and type in the name of this book? And you're going to find a bunch of copies of this book available for online browsing and perusal. And when you click into it, you will see the book itself displayed along with hopefully a borrow for 14 days. If you are logged in, you can borrow this book and read through the book. Great, wonderful. If you are not logged in, you will see a login and borrow. If you don't want to log in, you will see a preview of this book that will end at a certain point, and then you won't be able to see any more of it. So you're looking for pages 19 and 20, but you're going to get to a certain paywall part, and then it's limited preview. Okay, so, and then there's the end of the book. So what do you do if it's in there? You do not have to log in and borrow, actually. You can just take a representative part of that phrase. Generally, I think it's best to use a very identifiable word. Emerged. Let's search for that word. A global elite has emerged over the past decade that has vastly more power than any other group on the planet. Each of the members of the superclass has the ability to regularly influence the lives of millions. Exactly. So you don't even have to log in. You don't have to borrow the book. You can search for the passage in question and find it. So that is a handy thing, and I hope you can understand the general power of this. Of course, it's not just for looking up a specific reference in a specific book, although it is handy for that. But I don't know, I won't say any book you can imagine, but certainly an awful lot, literally millions of books are available through this. Now, as people who have been following the archive.org saga know, unfortunately, there have been problems in recent years with the legal saga, with the publishers. So there are quite a number of books now that you cannot borrow anymore, but you can still search inside of them and find representative passages like that. And there are many, many other books that are available for borrow through archive.org. So I would say that's a pretty handy resource for you if you're interested in such things. Here's another thing that you can do. Hopefully, again, you are familiar with archive.org, and you hopefully are familiar with Wayback Machine. I would imagine a lot of my listeners are familiar with the Wayback Machine, but I know a lot of people aren't. And I know that because I do get emails from time to time from people who are browsing one of my 14-year-old articles or 17-year-old videos, and they notice in the show notes, this link is broken, James. Well, yes, unfortunately, I can't check through every single one of the literally, I would imagine, hundreds of thousands of links on CorbettReport.com every single day to find more broken links. That would be a fool's errand. But if you do come across a broken link, here is something you can do. You can use the Wayback Machine. So let's look at a very specific example. Here's an article I wrote a couple of years ago, The Necessarily Incomplete, Inarguably Ridiculous List of Things Caused by Climate Change, which is actually a great article. I wish more people knew about it and read it. I think it is a fascinating example of this. But it proceeds from something called the Warm List, which is this thing that somebody was creating and maintaining and curating back in 2003, in which they had this list of things that were caused by climate change, according to various news stories. And literally, you have to see this list to believe it. It is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of entries long and includes everything, including Earth to Explode. And when you click on that in this article, you will find a link to that article from the original source, but one that has been preserved in the Wayback Machine. So no second chance. Can Earth explode as a result of global warming? Yes. You will note that almost every single one of the links in this warm list that's been preserved in my article here is a link to the Wayback Machine, because this list was originally compiled in 2003. So almost every single one of these links is now broken. So I went through the unbelievably painstaking process of putting each and every one of these articles into the Wayback and finding an archived version so that you can go and see them, and they are preserved and available for viewing today. So I hope you appreciate that, but secondarily, I hope you also appreciate the Wayback Machine and what it can do to revivify information. It's gone. That article is gone. This link is broken. What can I do? The Wayback Machine is, I would say, generally speaking, the first thing I check when I come across a broken link like that. Now, of course, not every link is available. Not every article has been preserved. Some of them have been deliberately scrubbed, so keep that in mind. But at any rate, 9 times out of 10, for an awful lot of information out there, you can revivify it through the Wayback Machine. So just type the URL or paste the URL into here, and it will provide you with the archived version of whatever you're looking for. All right, moving right along with our list. While we are on archive.org, let's look at tip number 8. There is, as I have had cause to point out before, I will point it out here again, something called the Television Archive News Search Service, which is a collection of 24/7 streaming from various news channels and news programs from around the world that goes back to 2009-10 in that era. And it is unbelievable the amount of information that has been preserved here as video that you can search. So let's see, if you wanted to search, for example, what was an early reference to Jeffrey Epstein in the establishment press? And let's see how far back it goes with references to Epstein. Oh, 2011, they started talking about Epstein in particular. And you can go and see, for example, on KNTV, March 8th, 2011. And here's the 7 a.m. to 11 a.m. broadcast slot. And when you click on that link, since you're searching for a specific search phrase, it's going to bring you not only to that program, but to the specific part of that program, the specific 1 minute chunk where that search term is stored. And you will be able to load that up and watch the video of that broadcast from, what, 15 years ago now. So there you go. This is a remarkable resource, and I hope people can appreciate how useful this can be if you're searching for something in particular, or maybe you just want to keep an eye on propaganda news establishment narratives, and this would be a handy resource for that. And there's a lot of stuff in here, actually, that gets preserved in one way or another. I noticed Curious George videos and cartoons and things. So it's not all news. There are things that get preserved in here that I'm not exactly sure what it's doing. But anyway, it's snarfing up an awful lot of data from around the world and from various television sources, including news sources. So that might be useful for you in your journeys online. But if it isn't, how about this? This is something called FameLac, famelac.com, and you can watch live television broadcasts from all around the world. What a fascinating and interesting resource. I wonder what's on in Iran right now. Let's take a look at Al-Walaya TV from Iran, and let's see if it's working. Yes, there it is. And obviously, this is just a small version of the browser, but you can make this larger as need be on your device. But anyway, and there it is. It's playing, and there is audio. I don't have it playing on audio right now. But anyway, so there's a bunch of Iranian TV stations for you to watch right now, or Angola, or whatever, Iceland. Ever wanted to watch Iceland TV? Panama. It's all here. It's quite an incredible, interesting resource. So if you want to keep an eye on television establishment media propaganda in any locale, here is a website that can help you do that. All right. And finally, the 10th idea for de-inshittifying the web. You notice how every program these days is not a program. You don't buy a software anymore like you used to back in the day and physically load it onto your computer with a disk or something. And then it's your program that you owned and you purchased and you get to keep. No. That doesn't exist anymore. It's all now software as a service, and you subscribe to some whatever it is, Adobe or Microsoft or whoever is providing the software, and they will deign to allow you to use this or to access this software online and to use it. And so you've noticed, for example, if you try to use image editing software, if you want to use Photoshop, well, you're going to have to use Photoshop and you're going to have to get an Adobe subscription of some sort. Who wants that? Now, of course, the simplest solution to that particular instance would be GIMP, which is a free open source online video photo editor. But anyway, not even online. You can download it as an actual program. So I always use GIMP. But if you are wedded to Photoshop for some reason, you can go to photopea.com, where you can act and interact and use this exactly as you would Photoshop. And you can open various sorts of files, Photoshop files, AI files, XD files, RAW files, PDF, etc. And you can do all the kinds of neat things that you can do in Photoshop right here on photopea.com. Why does this exist? How does this exist? Is this open source? You know, good question. I don't know. Let's find out about Photopea. My name is Ivan Kushker, and I'm the creator of Photopea. I'm a 33-year-old computer programmer, born in Ukraine, live in Czech. Started developing Photopea back in 2012. My friends and family didn't know about Photopea during the first 4 years of development. I'm spending a lot of time. Now it's heartwarming to know that millions are everywhere in the world using. Okay, great. Cool. Well, anyway, here it is, guys. So if you want to basically use Photoshop without buying anything or subscribing to Adobe, here you go. It's something, and it's remarkably simple to use. If you use Photoshop, you can just use it like that. So there you go. That's something that you can use instead of giving Adobe your money. Those are 10 examples. And yeah, they may be trivial examples in certain cases. They may be important examples, depending on what research purposes you are employing or whatever. But anyway, these are things that we can do to claw back a little bit of the awe, wonder, and utility of the early web. But I am, of course, as always, interested in hearing your ideas. There are doubtless hundreds of more little tools, tips, and things that people can do to improve their online experience. So I'd be interested to hear about them. As always, Corporate Report members invited to log into corporatereport.com and report back to headquarters. Leave your comment in the comment section of this post on corporatereport.com about any tools, tips, or tricks that you have for de-inshittifying your daily browsing experience. That's going to do it for today. I am James Corbett of CorporateReport.com, thanking you for investing me in this exploration, and I'm looking forward to talking to you again in the near future.
The deep state. False flags. 9/11 truth. The Federal Reserve. Secret wars and hidden histories. Fake news. Medical martial law, ceaseless propaganda. James Corbett, reportage, essays on the New World Order, available where books are sold, until they're not.
Reportagebook.com.